Yay, podcast night!
This episode is brought to you by Major Spoilers VIP members.
VIP stands for very important people, and their small monthly contributions ensure that this podcast remains free for all of you.
If you would like to become a bronze, silver, or gold VIP member, go to members.majorspoilers.com for more information.
I sure do thank you for your support. Now, here's your show.
The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course spoilers, and goes into detail about the topics discussed. So, if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items they talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Ashley.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, new friends for the Maid of Might, old friends for the Scarlet Speedster, and a scruffy-looking nerf herder who makes the kettle run in less than five parsnips. We got the scoop on America's best comics and the arcane mysteries of Promethea, and you choose the trade paperback for a future MSP. It's hot outside my window, but there's nothing cooler than our podcast team. Or at least Rodrigo and Ashley. So grab yourself a big kahuna burger and a tasty beverage to wash it down, Brad, because the Major Spoilers podcast is on the air.
Welcome to issue 682 of the Major Spoilers podcast. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing this episode with a friend. And a special thank you to everyone who is a Major Spoilers VIP. Without your help, we couldn't do this stuff week after week. And if you'd like to help us out, point your browser to members.majorspoilers.com and sign up today. Matthew's here, Rodrigo's here, Ashley is here. I think your hiccups are now contagious.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I like how we were worried about Ashley's hiccups at the beginning of the show.
Let us get to some news. We've got three interesting stories this week. Flashpoint will kick off season three of The Flash. Superman has been cast for season two of Supergirl, and yet another Ghostbusters animated series is on the way. Let's spin that wheel of destiny, see where we land. There it lands right there on number two. We have a brand new Superman for the second season of Supergirl, now on the CW. Its premiere date is October 12th. That is a Monday night. And announced this week, Teen Wolf star Tyler Hoechlin, I think is his name.
Hoechlin.
Hoechlin. I don't know how to pronounce that guy's name. Hoechlin has been tapped to play Superman and Clark Kent for the second season of Supergirl. Andrew Kreisberg said, Greg and I have always wanted to work with Tyler, and so this worked out perfectly because he is Superman, and we're thrilled and humbled to add another amazing actor to the legacy of this iconic character. So what does everyone think? Tyler Hoechlin, have you guys seen him in Teen Wolf before?
No. I have.
Is he good?
I'm over 25. I'm not allowed to watch Teen Wolf.
He's good, but he is definitely living in a different world than the rest of the cast. He's living in a very hardcore, like, cop drama. And most of them are living on a CW show. And then Styles is like living in a sketch comedy video. Okay. He wears a beard for most of the show, which I think is interesting. I mean, it's not like he can't shave, but part of me is really hoping that that we're going to get like bearded new 52 Superman.
Oh, yeah. Maybe earlier this year, he was in Everybody Wants Some, the Richard Linklater movie, where he sports a big old cheesy 1980s mustache. But I was watching about a half hour of the movie before we recorded tonight. The dude is ripped, and he looks like he could easily be a Superman. He's got the cool haircut, at least in the Everybody Wants Some movie. And his acting chops are really good. Of everybody that I've seen in the movie so far, him and the lead character are the two that I find most interesting and most likable. So I think this is a good move. For the first season, Matthew, all we did was we get to see Superman backlit from the sun. We got to see Clark Kent typing instant messages to Kara, and we got to see a pair of boots on the table. But now we actually get a
see that in one long shot of him flying in and then immediately getting sucked down into the hive mind.
Oh, yeah, that was a CG thing, though. Yeah. So is this a good thing that we're getting some live-action Superman or not?
Yes and no. It is good that we have live-action Superman because while I was not bothered by it, a lot of people have repeatedly been saying, well, this Superman thing is stupid. We need to see Superman. Can't just have this one. And I'm fine with that, and I understand the validity behind it. I think my big worry is making sure you're doing Supergirl justice in a world where Superman exists. Because if it, you know, I don't want Supergirl to end up being Superman's sidekick. I wouldn't mind an episode or two where maybe she has to deal with the issues of all of a sudden, hey, here's Superman and he's really in my life. And now everybody in the city is thinking of me as, you know, Robin, the super strong girl wonder, which again, different movie, pretty good too. I based on the sole impact of the image on the site, mm-hmm. I'm down with it. I think he's got it. I really hope that he keeps his beard, but they Cesar Romero it like they did in the old Batman
where,
series.
Where he's got to
put makeup over the beard and just face paint to hide the beard, because I think that would be a lovely nod to continuity.
Rodrigo, Matthew does bring up a good point, and it is something that has concerned me, is that if they don't do this right, Superman will overshadow Supergirl in her own series.
Yeah, they've been playing around, or they've been dancing around that. They've also been this announcement and actually casting an actor with an actual face kind of does two things for you. One, it kind of finally puts that nail on the coffin of this being in any way related to the movies. And I know that Jimmy Olsen is different and blah, 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 but not having a Superman, like, I always felt that they were like kind of like wanting to leave that door open. Now finally it's closed, and I think that's good for the show.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you do run that risk. You run the risk of like, well, now that you have someone on the payroll to pay Superman to be Superman, you want to use them. And the adventures of Supergirl and Superman will, you know, always have run the risk of becoming the new Adventures of Superman, which is also a different show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ashley, how do you say his name again? Hecklin? Hoikland?
Hecklin.
Hecklin. So do we know, and maybe you know, is he a recurring character or is he a regular cast member?
I do not know currently. It is my hope that he is a recurring character, maybe four times, have mm-hmm. him show up. Mm-hmm. In the premiere for the big mid-season two-parter, and then for the big crossover that's going to happen.
Right.
Because here's the thing. You brought up a really valid concern about him, Superman outshining Supergirl. We had to have Supergirl saved by Superman in the first mm-hmm. season mm-hmm. when Superman mm-hmm. wasn't even cast.
Right.
However, you have to appreciate the fact that the show's going to a new network that obviously wants it there, and that they are literally throwing everything at the wall. Like, they're going big or going home with this to make sure mm-hmm. that they can get the second season, I guess, up to snuff.
Now, do we know who is coming back and who is not coming back yet?
I don't think we have a lot of confirmation about that. I mean, we know Linda Carter, she was announced today.
Right.
She'll be joining the show. I mean, the only safe assumption is Melissa Benoist at this point.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I was concerned about that, too, because I had not seen anything about John Jones returning, the guy who plays him, which makes me think that Superman could end up stepping in as the Martian Manhunter character.
No.
In this series. Now, I don't know anything. That's just me seeing a lot of things on the show and not seeing when they did the CW upfronts. Melissa Benoist was the only one that was there. They didn't have any of the other casts there.
He's in South Africa right now shooting a Nelson Mandela biopic.
Ah, okay. Well, then that's probably why
Instagram.
Isn't there.
Right now, what are you talking about?
Okay. So, yeah, that was something that concerned me. And I was like, I really hope that he is not stepping in to be the replacement for Martian Manhunter, because if the CW and Berlanti Productions want to build this right, they mm-hmm. need to have Martian Manhunter. They need Superman. I don't know. Do we know who Linda Carter is playing?
The president of the United States.
Oh, that's right. President of the United States. We've got
president
her coming
Lawrence.
In.
Awesomely.
We've got, everybody over on Arrow and The Flash and DC's Legends of Tomorrow. I think if they do it right, you can have Superman in a quarter of the episodes, maybe not mm-hmm. 20. Yeah, about a quarter of the episodes, and it won't overshadow anything, but it will build and build and build. And man, with Superman, The Flash, Supergirl, I think we're on our way to a Legion of Superheroes TV show.
I think that's not a terrible prediction.
Yeah.
We've already got a time traveler in place, so it'll be easy to set up.
We have a couple of time travelers, right? We'll Rip Hunter and the Legends of Tomorrow guys. It wouldn't surprise me. We've got the JSA coming. I think we're going to see a Booster Gold coming in next season on on Legends of Tomorrow. So I think we could really see...
Inexplicably have Hourman.
Yeah. I really think we are going to see a Legion of Superheroes show. And if you had Flash, Supergirl, and Superman all traveling to the future, I think you could do it very easily. And it wouldn't even have to be Flash.
Yeah, that's where you throw in your Brainiac 5 and everybody will be like, oh no, Brainiac!
Yeah.
I love Brainiac 5.
What are some exciting things about this announcement?
That it opens up a whole new realm of bad guys for them to fight, because if you have two Kryptonians fighting on the same side, then you could have bigger and better threats than maybe just people who rolled out of Fort Ross.
Yeah.
Well, half of the villains in season one were technically Superman villains, if you go back to the original. But
you are not wrong.
The big play here is that they've established this whole thing where she was sent to Earth to protect her baby cousin, who is now older than her. And if they do it right, you can really play with that dichotomy of I'm supposed to be taking care of you. And, you know, of course, he's taking care of her. We've seen that. He's looking out for her because he's been on Earth longer. There's a lot of really cool family stuff you can play with there. And if they play with it right, they can, you know, do something as strong as the sister bond she has with Baby Gray that
Alex.
I think could be really good. Yeah. I only know her from Grey's Anatomy and that 80s show, which was terrible. So,
oh, who did she play on the 80s show?
Do you remember the girl with the great big punk spike hair?
Oh, my gosh.
That's Shyler Lee.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, see, you learn something new every day. Rodrigo,
that, I think, was her first role.
What are some great things that are going to come out of this?
I think I'm not sure. I think you do have the opportunity for that relationship stuff, and that's really what this brings you, right? A pull away from her real family to her Kryptonian family, because, you know, her adoptive family is obviously not related to Clark Kent. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like this has the opportunity to give us some very good mundane stuff like Thanksgiving dinner. Should I go?
Oh, yeah. Should we go to the North Pole or stay here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, stuff like that.
All right, cool. All right, listeners, we want to hear your feedback on potential greatness, potential not so greatness about Superman coming to Supergirl in season two. You can go over to majorspoilers.com. Use the comment section over there and share your thoughts, because we're very interested in those. And if you want to find out a little bit more about our thoughts on the Flashpoint story for the first episode, at least, of season three, head over to members.majorspoilers.com. We've got a little bonus bit over there for you regarding that. News is out of the way. Why don't we hit some reviews?
Reviews.
And Ashley has to bump out a little bit early this week. So Ashley, why
just
don't...
useless.
I know, but you're going to share a wonderful comic with us this week and share your thoughts on that.
I am. So I was very fortunate to get my hands on Wonder Woman number one early. So yay. I'm going to give a spoiler-free take on that. So it is not the Wonder Woman Rebirth issue. It is the number one series that launches her ongoing. And this is the Lies storyline, which is the present day one drawn by Liam Sharp. And if you read the first Wonder Woman issue, the Rebirth issue, for me, it looked really great, but nothing happened.
Mm-hmm. And it was kind of confusing.
Yeah, and it was a lot of like, we're telling you what Rebirth is, but like, I already know what Rebirth is, so blah. Unfortunately, number one is a lot of the same thing. We have Diana going to a new and exciting location and shouting into the void at what I can only assume will someday be revealed to be the villain. about how she's lost her time, except it's unclear whether it is now 5 or 15 years. So that's a thing. But the cool thing about the issue is that it does introduce some characters that are name-checked throughout Wonder Woman's history. We meet Etta Candy and we meet Steve Trevor. I will say that they are not perhaps the incarnations that we are most familiar with, and they may or may not take inspirations from the Earth One version that Grant Morrison and Yannick Paquette published earlier this year. That is actually the most interesting part of it, is seeing how those two characters fold into this world. When you read it and you see Etta Candy for the first time, I defy you to not mistake her for another powerful DC woman that may or may not be involved in the Suicide Squad movie. Because I did.
Harley Quinn, right? We're all talking about Harley Quinn.
Yeah, of course. Like shorty shorts and everything. Yeah, totally.
Pigtails and the little ombre hair thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's Daddy's little monster written on her.
Very on fleek. So I would say that the unfortunate thing is that you have a really talented writer and an incredibly talented artist who really don't do anything that incredible in this issue. And I'm worried that the year one Nicholas Scott story is going to be the standout and that the modern day story is going to look really good and kind of make no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So because there was something interesting that happened, but it was mostly still just a recap of the rebirth, I'm going to give it 3 out of 5 because I really want to like it.
Yeah.
So I'm choosing to like it.
All right, cool. I have yet to read it. I do also have an early copy of it sitting right here.
I have an early copy.
In fact, I have an early copy of The Flash number 1 sitting right here.
Hey, I read 2.
Yeah. So let me start by talking about the art really quick. I think the art is really solid in a flashy kind of way. not trying to make too many puns out of it, but
such a perfect descriptor though.
The one thing that is a little bit of a detraction is all the characters are kind of have some fancy pants poses. Like, for example, Barry is putting on a pair of rubber gloves, and he looks like one of those guys you would see in a manga comic who is about to reveal that he is Sailor Moon's boyfriend or something.
Oh, Tuxedo Mask is so
awesome. Yeah. So there's some weirdness every once in a while in their poses. But overall, I think the art is really, really solid, especially when we throw in some lightning effects, because in this story, we are introduced to Barry Allen, of course, and he gives us a lot of backstory of what's happened so far, who he is, his time as the Flash, some of the problems that he has at the Flash.
Does it start with my?
Yes, it does. It actually does. We get a little bit of a prequel before the first commercial break kind of thing, where he and I think he's just another police officer, August, are talking about Barry helping him to solve this murder that his brother may be involved in. And then that's the moment when Barry is struck by lightning, becomes the Flash, and this officer, August, sees it all happening. And then we flash forward to a present time. And again, Barry is talking about, hey, my best friend Wally West is back, and I love the fact that he's back. And Batman and I are working on some kind of a secret detective thing because someone's taken 10 years of our lives and made us forget everything, and everything's wonderful, except I'm Barry Allen. I'm the fastest man alive, and yet I can't be in two places at once. The title of this arc is called Deus Ex Machina. It's Lightning Strikes Twice, Part 1. And you can imagine that if we are introduced in the first page to a new character that we've never met before, and the title of the series is Lightning Strikes Twice, and Barry is concerned that he can't be in two places at once, I think without revealing too many spoilers, you can put 2 and 2 together and come up with another Flash running around in the DC universe. The other thing that I like that's kind of nice is Barry is still always late to everything. He is late to a crime scene. He's late to a lunch with Iris and the other Wally West, her in-universe, New 52 universe nephew. So that's kind of interesting that they're trying to tie it all together. And again, if you are reading the rebirth stuff and especially focusing on the Flash aspect of it, this just feels like another chapter in the rebirth saga. And I thought it read really, really well. I actually enjoyed the story, even though a lot of it is, here's what's happened before. This is what I am. This is what I do. This is a number one. You can tell that they're trying to say, hey, there's more of the TV universe that we're going to try to smear into this. But also hoping that a lot of new readers are jumping back on board and want to get caught up quickly. And I think this issue does it. Is it perfect? No. Is the art great? I think it works. But I'm also giving this 3.5 slices of meatloaf out of 5. I enjoyed it. I enjoy The Flash tremendously. I'm going to keep reading this series to see how it improves. And I really want to see what's going on with this lightning thing. So it's my review of The Flash number 1 out this week from DC Comics.
Nice.
Yes. Let's jump to a Marvel title, Matthew.
A Galaxy Far, Far Away, perhaps.
Maybe.
a story set long, long ago, but not as long ago as some stories, yet less long ago as that last movie. Star Wars: Han Solo number 1 from Marvel Comics. Check it out. It's really kind of like this comic, and it's written by Marjorie Liu, who, by the way, I love. Art by Mark Brooks. And I believe this takes place in the lacuna between Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back. So, this is basically a time when the Rebellion has destroyed the first Death Star, but things are not going well for Han Solo. Throughout this first half of this issue, we find Han basically with a big case of what they refer to as the yips. He keeps turning... What? You never heard that? He's turning down jobs that he should be able to finish.
Yeah.
It's not the yip, tally.
It would be funny.
Different thing. Different thing. And then he discovers he's being followed.
Uh-oh.
And if you see the same person...
Go ahead.
If you see the same person on two planets, says Han Solo, it means bad things.
Mm.
It's not good.
Okay.
But it turns out that the aliens following him are in the employ of a very, very, very dangerous individual, someone who's run afoul of before.
Darth Vader?
General Leia Organa of the Rebel Alliance. Yes. Who is calling him for help. She has a mission only he can finish. She has what they believe to be a mole in the Federation or the Alliance. Yes, the Rebel Alliance.
The Federation. Federation.
Sorry. Yes. J.J. Abrams directs everything now. It's all the same universe. But she, in order to figure out who her mole is, she needs someone that she can trust, but someone that the rest of the Rebellion doesn't trust. Guess who? I'll give you a hint.
Is it Luke Skywalker?
No, it's not Luke Skywalker.
Oh, man. I'm so bad at this game.
It's not Greedo.
Is it C-3PO?
It's not C-3PO. Stay with me. What's the title of the
book? It's a General Akbar?
Yes, oh, damn. Admiral Akbar. Admiral Akbar is going to save the day. No. What she has done is she has taken the liberty of entering the Millennium Falcon in a legendary multi-system space race to pick up some of her hidden underground people who were embedded in the evil guys with the thing in the face.
Oh, so those are the mole people she's after.
Right, those are the mole people. But she has not necessarily entered Han, because she doesn't think she can trust him. So the ship is in, but of course he's not willing to go without the ship or let the ship go without him. So what we get in the second half of the issue is very much a serious space cannonball run setup, which I am 100% on board. Ooh,
who's Jackie Chan?
I know, right? There's who are the green people?
That one Asian pilot from Force Awakens.
There you go.
The Twi'leks. Those are the green people with the floopies on their heads. Yes. There's a Twi'lek pilot, yes. And there's a legendary pilot. Of course, there's a hotshot with blue skin, and then there's this ancient weird fish alien lady who is a legend in the racing industry. And of Han Solo and Chewbacca agree that they're going to go and they're going to race across these three systems and pick up the hidden spies and also not die. Except at the end of the issue, that last part goes a little pear-shaped on them. I really like this. This is weird because it's hard for me to read a Star Wars story and not feel like I know a lot of the beats. That was my biggest complaint about the Expanded Universe. And Expanded Universe fans, please don't light my house on fire. But some of it was a little predictable, and there were a lot of stories that basically consisted of once again recasting the events of Star Wars, that first movie, or Episode 4, as some people would call it, over and over and over again. And you have that same Rebels against the overarching bad guys, and you blow up a thing, and then you do a thing. Three of the seven movies have this plot. This is not that. This is something entirely unseen to me, at least in the Star Wars universe. I really like it. 3.5 slices of meatloaf overall. Really well drawn. It doesn't look like Harrison Ford, but it does look like Han Solo in every single panel.
Does it look like Han Solo from the original Marvel series run?
No.
Which also did not look like Harrison Ford. Well,
okay, that was Carmine Infantino. Carmine Infantino's characters look like nothing other than a character drawn by Carmine Infantino. So, that's like saying, does a Gil Kane character look like a real human being? No, he's got massive nostrils and a forehead.
I was just wondering, you said he didn't look like Han Solo in this book. I was wondering if he looked like Han Solo from the original comic series.
Well, He looks like Han Solo. He doesn't look like Harrison Ford.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They managed to pull that off, and that is an extremely difficult proposition for me.
All right.
But every pose, every facial expression, everything in this issue says Han Solo to me, but it doesn't necessarily look like a photorealistic Harrison Ford. And I think that is a big selling point with my major complaint when it comes to those sort of things. So,
all right, cool.
Yeah.
Rodrigo, what do you have for us this week?
I have creepy.
Oh, no.
Yep.
You mispronounced am.
Yes, I am. I am half creepy for you. yeah, Creepy Comics number 24 from Dark Horse. So Creepy is a horror anthology. And each issue has multiple spooky stories. This one has several of them. Some of them are monster stuff. Some of them are undead things. But so Creepy is like even more ambitious than like a Dark Horse Presents. Like it some of the old anthology comics, it really tries to get you multiple done in one stories in a single like 20 like 30-ish page comic. And interestingly, on the cover of Creepy, it says a shocking salvo of stunning scenarios.
Wow.
That's actually kind of what it feels like. A lot of the time, it just kind of feels like this premise of something that would be interesting as a longer story, but then is just kind of over with. First story, it's called The Hymn of Ordeal number 23, and I haven't read the most recent Creepy Comics to know whether it's like the number 23 is just a weird part of this title or whether that's actually a serial. So that's interesting, because it does seem like a thing that would continue, but also it seems very self-contained. So story-wise, it's a lot of the stories feel kind of lacking because they're just done so quickly. There's a few like funny things, like there's this one that I actually think Matthew would really like. There's like two-page thing called A Deep Connection, where like this these guys are like messing with this nerdy boy, and he's like, "Hey, that," or like he's like a creepy little kid, and he's like, "Hey, he looks like Eddie Munster." He's like, "He looks like that guy," and then somebody else is like, yeah, he looks like Melvin Monster, ha ha ha. And then he turns around and is like, Melvin Monster? He's like, you mean the guy from the John Stanley book? Is like, of course, stupid. And then they start talking about it, and they start talking about like old EC comics. And he's like, he kind of like weirdly bonds with his bully. It's actually like a really cute, like two page, like six panel per page kind of thing. It's interesting. Honestly, the real reason to get this comic is the art, because we're talking about several little vignettes of horror art in like drastically different styles, from like hyper thatched like pen kind of stuff to like soft grays, kind of like watercolor looking stuff. It's all in black and white, but most of these look really good. You know, there's really nothing, no real issues with it other than like they just try to pack so much in here. I'm going to give Creepy Comics number 24 3.5 slices of meatloaf. It's fun. You should check it out. And again, if you're into that sort of creepy, like old school EC comics art, this is actually something you should check out.
Cool. That is out this week from Dark Horse.
That is out this week, yes.
All right, excellent. All right, Rodrigo, Matthew, Ashley, thank you so much for your reviews. And everyone, you can head over to majorspoilers.com and check out more reviews at the site. And I think this is a part of the program where we have to bid Ashley adieu.
Adieu.
I'm so sorry that you have to
adieu.
Go. But when you're a busy mover and shaker like Ashley is, we always appreciate every little chance we get to spend with you.
Au revoir, mon petit coco.
Au revoir. A bientôt. Right. I'll see you next week. I'll be here for real.
All right.
Yeah,
take
we'll
care.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye now.
We'll believe it when we see it.
All right. Another thing that's over on the Major Spoilers website is the Major Spoilers poll of the week.
Poll of the week.
Week. It is time once again for you, the listeners, to decide what book we will read. Oh, there it is. The poll. On a future Major Spoilers podcast. So up for this month, we have Bill and Ted's Triumphant Return. We have Arkham Asylum, A Serious House on Serious Earth. Tokyo Ghost and Superman, Batman Generations, which really looks at different generations of Batman and Superman and their children throughout time.
Space and dimension. Ooh, yeah. Scary stuff. Blah.
Do you have a preference, Matthew? I mean,
I do.
This is all up to the listeners to vote on.
I do. Absolutely, listeners. Don't force me to read Superman, Batman Generations. Oh, that would be terrible. I actually do really love Superman, Batman Generations. And the way it plays out, at least the first series, there's a second and a third, and each one kind of expands on the themes. And as with any expansion, sometimes it opens off stuff that maybe I didn't want them to mess with.
Right, exactly.
But the first one starts in the year 1939 and follows as though the DC universe had progressed in real time.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time it gets to the end, it gets really freaky. And I think it ends in the year 2019.
Something like that.
Yeah, which at the time was like 20 years in
this
the
is
future.
A John. That's a John Byrne joint, isn't it?
That is all Byrne all the time.
Yep. So when you get to see old superhero characters, for some reason, they all look like Granny Goodness to me. But that's okay. I'm also one that is hoping that our listeners pick Superman, Batman Generations, because it is so different and so interesting and so weird. And that's interesting because there's also another Batman book on this list. Rodrigo, what do you think of the listeners, get up there on your stump and, rally the voters.
Okay. Well, so, real quick, I will say that I have a deep appreciation for a book called A Serious House on Serious Earth. I really have to go with my heart here and pitch Bill and Ted. There's been Bill and Ted comics before. There was a cartoon, but this is a good opportunity to get some Bill and Ted into the podcast, and maybe a good last opportunity to get some good Bill and Ted before the movie comes out.
Okay. There you go. We don't know when that movie's coming out, though.
Who knows?
And we don't know if it's going to be good Bill or bad Ted.
Yeah.
All right, listeners.
Or evil robot usses.
A serious Bill on serious Ted.
So John says everything is better with Batman. Bill and Ted do it for Rodrigo. Ingrid says Tokyo Ghost sounds intriguing. And Jeffrey says Bill and Ted because I know how their saga ends. It's interesting that a lot of people are saying Bill and Ted because, Matthew, what is the current vote rank at?
As of right this very second, I am seeing 45 votes in the bank, 29% of the vote leaning towards your Bill and your Ted. Mm-hmm. 18% Superman, Batman Generations, 24% for Arkham Asylum, and 29% for Tokyo Ghost. So actually, there's a tie.
Yeah.
I was just looking at the numbers wrong because they are above the bar and not below the bar.
Yeah. That was throwing me off too because I was like, how's Batman Superman Generations at 18% and the bar is the same as Bill and Ted's Triumphant Return?
What the heck?
Bobby, get off them video games.
Bobby.
Video games.
Bobby, what did I tell you about messing with them bar graphs?
Yep. So it looks like Tokyo Ghost, which is an Image Comics one, Matthew? Because we read the first issue of that.
I
think it's Image Comics.
I don't remember if it's an Image or a Dark Horse. It feels Dark Horsey in my head.
Well, let us look really quick.
Because it's all cyberpunk and...
Nope, Image Comics.
Oh, so it is Image. Yeah. It's a Dark Horsey Image comic.
Do you guys ever... It's interesting because sometimes a publisher will surprise me because when Matthew and I do the dueling reviews, I go down the list and then we get into the and the other category
that
just puts everybody together. And sometimes I sit there going, I think that one's coming out from Boom Studios. And you would think like a book like Pokey and Grumpy Cat and Pokey would be from Boom Studios, but it's actually from like Dynamite Entertainment.
Mm.
And that always throws me off. And so I wonder how often do you guys look at titles and say, especially indie titles, not like Batman or something like that. But you look at a title like Tokyo Ghost and you're like, is that Dark Horse? Is that Oni? Is that Image?
Yeah.
I do that a lot, especially with the licensed titles.
Yeah, definitely.
Where you'll be like, hey, they just crossed over, So clearly it's with Dynamite, but no, it was actually an intercompany crossover.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and your brain is just like, I'm sure Red Sonja is with Dark Horse, but it's right. not. It's with Dynamite.
Dynamite.
And I thought that, you know, Dynamite had the G.I. Joe, but it turns out that's IDW.
Yeah. I'm getting better, but sometimes you get in the way I look at it is, does this look like it's a creator-owned book? If it's a creator-owned book, it's either at Image or Top Cow. And everybody else is just, you know, up for grabs.
Image Cow.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Cow. Rodrigo?
Yeah, I mean, it is just, especially if I sit there and I'm like, is this in the public domain? And it's like, if it is, then who knows, right? It could just be a grab bag.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
But based on how something sounds, it's like the smidgen. It's like, that sounds like a Dark Horse thing.
Yeah, yeah. Right now, Dark Horse seems to be focused on the gaming properties, especially with, Eidos with Tomb Raider. So they focus on a lot of the game properties. They've still got some Hellboy stuff running around, BPRD stuff running around. And they occasionally have some horror, or I guess the other thing is they have is the horror stuff.
Yeah.
But anytime I see something that's creator owned, first thing I think of is Image Comics. And then if it's something that is pulpy, that's always Dynamite. And then if it seems like it's kid friendly ish, that's where I usually think it's Boom.
If it seems like the title is literally just an elevator pitch, then it's probably IDW.
That like, might actually be Action Lab, too.
Yeah, that too. That too. You're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. All right, listeners, head over to majorspoilers.com. Cast your vote in the Major Spoilers poll of the week. And in a couple of weeks, I think it's like a 3 or 4 weeks from now, we will hit whichever one you list. I will point out that our July 5th episode of Major Spoilers, I almost said three different podcasts right there. We do so many. I started to say Critical Hit, and then I was like, no. And then I started to say Munchkin Land. I was like, no. And then Major Spoilers. Our July 5th episode, we'll kind of have a longer talk about history of Major Spoilers because we're turning 10 years old in just a few days. Yay.
Ooh.
So if you have any...
We already act like we're 10 years old.
If you have any comments or thoughts or things that you want to send our way, do it now. You could even call the Major Spoilers hotline and share some thoughts on our 10 years. Matthew, what is that number?
Yay! 785-727-1939. The Major Spoilers old school flashback hotline.
Yeah. Oh, we're doing a lot of old school stuff. People are like surprised. Yeah. A couple of people have said, man, your shows have been really short lately. It's like, no, we originally wanted to keep this show at an hour. And we've been trying to stay closer to that than pushing it for the 2 hours like we used to do quite a bit. So anyway, this episode of the Major Spoilers podcast is being sponsored by Tweaked Audio. Oh, man, I love my Tweaked Audio earbuds that I take with me when I go on my bike rides or when I go on my walks. Great sound production. I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks, podcasts, music. Doesn't matter what you're listening to. It all sounds great with a pair of Tweaked Audio headphones. Head over to tweakedaudio.com. Use the checkout code MAJOR. And save 33% off the price. And I do believe, Rodrigo, that also includes anything that you buy at tweakedaudio.com.
Oh, good. Because there's some cases that I've been looking at.
Excellent.
Like the hard case.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, excellent. Major hard is case. The checkout code. Tweakedaudio.com is the sponsor. And the Tweaked Audio earbuds, the earphones, are what you want. All right. Let us talk Promethea Volume 1. This is by Alan Moore with art by... Who's the art on this one? I keep
J.H. Williams the
third. J.H. the Williams the third, the guy that does the Starman stuff.
Starman. That's a different guy. Batwoman.
Batwoman stuff.
Yes. Batwoman's big thing in Detective Comics when the new Batwoman came out and everything was like, hey, this is amazing. Williams, man.
J.H. Williams does such a fantastic job with the art. That's the thing that blows me away in this first volume is just how freaking fantastic the art is.
Yep.
In that, and if you're familiar with his work in Batwoman, where he would literally take like a Batwoman symbol and break it into a 2-page spread with different parts of the bat and wings filling out the panels. That's kind of what's going on here in Promethea a lot of times when we're talking about different gods or different concepts or different mystical beings. He does that a lot in this piece, and I really, really dig it. I think the other thing that's really cool is we're jumping back and forth through a lot of different time periods. And so the setting and the environment also plays a big role. And the attention to detail just in the backgrounds is, again, something that blows my mind.
Yeah, and that is really one of the hallmarks of the America's Best Comics stuff from 98, 99, 2000. There's so much detail and there's so much just built into the universe that they don't call out for you until mm-hmm. you go looking for it. Mm-hmm. Top 10 was the same way. Top 10 was full of visual gags and things. This is set in that same universe, and it's as though you're kind of, this is the first six issues of the series, but you're kind of stuck in a world that feels like they've been putting out comics for years.
Right. Yeah. Rodrigo, what is Promethea about? We've been talking about some of the art, but why don't we tell the listeners what the story is about?
Yeah, so Promethea is the story of a character named Promethea, who is actually like 20 different people. Promethea is a really kind of clever take on the legacy character, right? It's the same way that you have your Jay Garrick, Barry Allen, Wally West Flash. Here you mm-hmm. have multiple women throughout time having taken the mantle of Promethea. And it's all through the fact that Promethea is essentially a living story. She is an actual person that lives in this other spiritual world of stories, and
the
can essentially
magic land.
Yeah, can essentially, yeah, the immateria as a whole is this thing, and it has like these subsections like the Misty Magic Land. Mm-hmm. And so she can come through and essentially inhabit a person while simultaneously existing as kind of these gestalt people still in the immateria. It is like, it's actually a weirdly complex concept while also just being like a very straightforward, is like, you are the Green Lantern now, mm-hmm. Kyle. Mm-hmm. Kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yep. There it seems to be, when I read this, so we're introduced to this character. It takes place in 1999, mm-hmm. An alternate world 1999, because they have flying cars and all sorts of cool stuff that we'll never have. We're introduced to Sophie Bangs, who is a college student who has been researching this character called Promethea, and she finds out that, you know, here's what happens to all these people over time, and that they've all written about Promethea or done pulp comics or books mm-hmm. about her. And so she goes to interview the last person who ever wrote about Promethea and discovers that if you write about Promethea, if you talk about Promethea, you're welcoming her to kind of take over your body and become the new Promethea for that time period. Yet all the essences of the other Prometheas exist out there in the magic lands. Mm-hmm. And so this first volume really takes a look at her coming to grips with what Promethea is, how you use your imagination powers to fight bad guys, and kind of explore the world of the magic lands of the immateria. And so mm-hmm. part of me when I'm reading this is like, oh yes, like Rodrigo, it is a take on heritage characters. But it also at times feels like this is part Shazam. It feels mm-hmm. like it's yes. part Sandman. It feels like it's part Starman. And it kind of feels like all those parts pushed together with Alan Moore telling us this story.
Yeah, and there's a lot of author stuff in here that Alan Moore loves, because you see, you know, his fascination with magic and symbology. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are bits and pieces of things in here that are actual, I don't know if I want to say history, but maybe, you know, myth and mythology of magics. And it's really kind of a synthesis of all the things that Alan Moore loves.
Yeah.
The real shame for me is that the first 12 issues of Promethea are a big arc.
Right. We're only getting half of that.
Right. And which means that we meet two of the previous Prometheas. We don't meet the one that I consider to be the most fascinating. And we don't get to the end of the arc where the things happen that are, in retrospect, kind of creepy.
Yeah, but I mean, in the greater scheme of things, depending on the volumes that you're reading at, Alan Moore essentially takes the book and turns it into a dissertation of his views on magic and the occult mm-hmm. and other things. So you could use it as a guidebook to Alan Moore's way of thinking or his belief system. Mm-hmm. But I think in this first volume, at least in the first six issues that we're reading, it really kind of is a fascinating story of, hey, here's this superpower being that is, you know, essentially Shazamming it. And we've got two people inhabiting the same body. And how are they dealing with that? How are they working with their powers? And I find it quite fascinating.
Yeah, it definitely has elements that are very metatextual, to kind of go beyond the standard, oh, well, yeah, Captain Marvel's a separate guy. This is something where we are reading a story about a girl who is reading a story about a story that is live. And so by reading that story, we are calling forth that story. So technically, yeah, we are all Promethea.
Well, there's an interesting part because in the way that the story folds in on itself so much, there's actually a part in the story where Sophie, who has visited the hospital of the person who was the previous Promethea, who is dying, Sophie passes out, and there's this whole other group of characters that are kind of like the Fantastic Four, but they're the, what are they? The
five swell guys.
The five swell guys.
Yes.
They come to the hospital, and one of them has the ability to read minds, and he goes in, and he's touching different people in the hospital and kind of getting visions of what they're seeing, and he goes and touches Sophie's mind, and they go into this totally different tale of Promethea that Sophie is experiencing, and at one point, Promethea is basically like, I think we're being watched. And then as she's talking about this pulp period and the writers that were writing under this pseudonym, how they kind of turned her into kind of this pervy kind of sexualized character. As it's getting real interesting in the story, suddenly Promethea turns and breaks the fourth wall and says, you creepy perv, you're not supposed to be reading this. And it's this startling moment where you're like, oh my gosh, is she talking to me? But then you turn the page and it's like, oh no, she's talking to the guy that was reading the mind. It was a really fascinating way of using this swell guy's powers to really tell a narrative that made sense in the context of what Promethea was talking about in her history.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that this is a universe where she's basically living in kind of a 20 minutes in the future metropolis with its own superheroes really does give this a weird feeling, because this character doesn't feel like your standard issue superhero, but she exists in a world where superheroes do exist.
Right. And so and even though the character has been around, she's been in poems, she's been in comic strips, she's been in pulp books and the like. People don't recognize her. People don't know who she is, but certainly the demons of the world know who she is. And apparently, Rodrigo, she has made a lot of people very angry.
Yeah, Promethea has been around for a long time, so we're introduced to just like a lot of people are name-checked, but we're introduced to a fraction of her rogues gallery. Probably most obviously these two demons that come after her very early on.
Yeah. And there's some, so that you get some cool battle action, you get some history, you get to see this character throughout time, like visiting, characters who were in World War One or people that were trapped in the trenches of World War One and her helping them out. And it to me, it's very fascinating. And I really dug a lot of it. And I've shared one of my favorite moments of the piece. Is there a favorite moment in this volume, Rodrigo, that really stands out for you?
I thought the high Brazil part was really clever. As an aside, sometimes Alan Moore just like fills up my potentiometer like a little too fast, and I have trouble digesting it. But I liked this. I thought it was clever. It's like in a world where like writers get this power, right? It's like if you're a writer, you're creating these things, and it's like, so if you make a fictional writer, then you're essentially creating this godlike being in this place. And then the way that our protagonist deals with him is, I felt, was also really clever.
Yes,
Matthew, what about you? Are there some favorite parts in here that you really really dig?
I really love that moment where the omnipotent writer is, and Sophie starts remembering the individual bits and pieces of each writer, which causes the creature to basically fall apart. She used her knowledge and her logic to, you know, cut him to pieces, literally and figuratively. And it's a really, really cool moment. I think this is a book that, well, I remember reading it when it first came, but I always got caught in the bits and pieces of it and the interactions of the characters. And what I really wanted to see more of was the Prometheus, like, sitting in shadow and watching. And we get a lot of that in, these six issues.
You do in this, where they're looking through the pool to see what's going on with the current Prometheus. Kind of feels like the Dr. Fate, Dr. Occult conversations where they're like, let us watch and weigh the scales of justice and see who this person is.
It reminds me of the live action Shazam. You remember when they had the animated elders sitting and
Yeah, there's something about this that's very fascinating, and I'm nervous to move ahead with this only because of what I've read with people are like, oh, wait until it starts to devolve into this. But I've seen a lot of people saying, regardless, this is a fantastic overall series of something that Alan Moore is putting together. And some people say it is one of his best works. Would you agree with that, Matthew?
100%. This is one of Moore's best, if not the best works, because he's free of the constraints of continuity that work against him. And this is a point in Moore's life where this is post-Watchmen, and he has come to the realization or the expectation that Watchmen and several other books created this darkness that engulfed the comic industry, and he's trying to intentionally tell stories that aren't the dark nihilistic stuff. And even though this book is literally a story about an idea designed to end the universe, and spoilers, she does.
Yes, the universe does end
in issue 30, but it's a really, really good story. And even the parts that are icky don't quite sink the whole affair.
Now, when you say the parts are icky, there's none of those icky parts really in this first volume. It seems to be all fairly straightforward, high hopes. You've got powers and responsibilities. Go use them wisely kind of stuff.
There is icky stuff here. There is icky stuff for me in Sophie's best friend, Stacia. Spends the majority of her appearance in these issues making fun of Sophie and calling her gay.
Right.
Which really bothers me because the relationship between them is cute and fluffy, but it's also got just this underlying unpleasant. At one point, they both fall asleep exhausted and they wake up and they immediately jump out of bed freaked out because they were sleeping in the same bed together.
I understand where you're coming from that, but sometimes I read it as like when Bill and Ted hug each other.
Here's the thing. That is an unfortunate moment in Bill and Ted.
Right.
Like that is a moment that I personally, who am a big fan of Bill and Ted, feel is really unfortunate in both movies when they basically use that word. So I definitely see where, I mean, I felt the same way. This is how the book opens, basically.
Right.
Yeah. It's just straight into the kind of gay bashing, and you have no context to be like, are they gay and are they just like, you know, doing that thing or what are we looking at? And it's never super clear. So this can definitely be taken as, you know, just even if it's just from a character and it's not necessarily the author's intent, like you can definitely feel that way. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the beginning was very off-putting because I was like, what's going on with this? But also... Mm-hmm. Is it just me or am I reading Sophie's original lines weird? Like she's talking in a weird slang, not Sophie, her friend, is talking some kind of, Stacia is talking in this weird slang that almost felt like the thugs from, The Dark Knight Returns, you know, the ones that were, that become later the Bat Knights.
Yeah. I can definitely see that. And again, this was one of those just a minute in the future settings. This is set in the same world as Tom Strong. This is set in the same world as, you know, the other ABC books. And it is not meant to be the world outside your window. But, yeah, that was something that's not as off-putting to me as the other part. But I think that part of that is they're trying to set us up for this futuristic world. Because immediately in issue one, when the five swell guys show up, they're on their floating hover platform.
They're on
there
with a giant five and a circle on the bottom. So, you know,
they're talking about our psychic here said that he read your mind and there was some sort of ancient conspiracy targeting you. You know, that moment is there. I feel like that part of the dialogue is to kind of not necessarily alienate you, but give you the idea that this is not just New York City. This is a weird kind of metropolitan futury world.
Now, was this when Alan Moore did this, was this pre or post FDC attitude? Because, you know, now he is like vehemently opposed to anything DC ever does.
Well, remember, America's Best Comics was published by Wildstorm. And the end of America's Best Comics came when Jim Lee sold out to DC and Alan said, I won't work for them anymore.
Okay.
And that's when America's Best Comics kind of just fell apart because Alan wasn't willing to work for the new owners.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah.
Interesting. What, so what are some things? I mean, we kind of already mentioned the gay bashing, which, you know, I agree that it's in overall it's bad. But what are some other things that were problematic or off-putting in this trade?
17 years doesn't feel like a lot of time until you sit down and read this book and think, my God, 17 years is a lot of time. And there are elements of this that are designed to be futuristic and spacey that 17 years later, in a time of social media, some of it feels really prescient. If you read the bits about this is texture and it's talking about, you know, the idea of the politicians as people who are basically public celebrity figures and all of that. But there are parts of it that are just a little bit embarrassingly twee.
Yeah,
the bits, you know, the bits, everything that takes place in the hospital to me is just kind of like, okay, let's just sweep by this with the fake doctor talk and the, oh no, we're going to clone her own skin. It'll be fine. I'm like, just shut up. Don't try and give me this hard science fiction stuff in a story that's about an idea come to life. And I know that that's the point and that's what Moore was doing here, but it just, there are parts of it that have not aged well. It was cutting edge stuff in 1999, cutting edge enough that in 2016, some of it still feels relevant. But with any attempt to predict what, you know, future worlds are going to be like, some of it's going to fall flat and some of it is just going to be like, yeah, different.
And I think that's the reason why they point out, and I think it's in the foreword of a book or something like that, that this is an alternate Earth. This is not supposed to represent the future in any way, shape, or form. But this is the future in an, if another Earth had done these things, focused more on science than on other stuff. And that's how we end up with the floating cars. So, you know, I look at that, a lot of that stuff, you know, hey, let's use her clone meat or whatever to graft her body back together. You know, I can just say, whatever. I mean, that's fine. It's not a big deal. At no point did I ever read this and go, wow, their future was way wrong when I was reading this. Because it's like, okay, I know that this is a different world. And so whatever they have is a product of their world, not our world.
Some of it just feels kind of not embarrassing exactly.
Yeah, I think I get what Matthew's getting at. It's not just the talk of the future. I think that there's a lot of so a lot of the guys who were writing during this period of time, like Alan Moore's contemporaries, are these like very cerebral guys. Your Alan Moore's, your Neil Gaiman's. Even your Grant Morrison's and stuff like that. And they're like, a lot of the time their books feels like they're sitting next to you and they're elbowing you in the ribs and then just going like, hey, you know what would be cool? If stories were like a baseball bat, and then this baseball bat, every time you use it, it tells you a story, but the story is actually your life and you discover that. And then like, it just like, there's a lot in this book that feels like somebody had a cool idea and they wedged it in here maybe to be explored later or whatever. And sometimes those ideas just kind of aren't that cool. They're just like, you know, it's interesting. It's like an interesting thing that happens. And unfortunately, unlike, say, a Sandman, where the format of the book really allows for that momentary like hit on cool ideas, this is a tighter story. And although there's a lot of weird stuff that you can fit stuff in, sometimes that stuff feels very extraneous.
So are those the parts that you didn't like, or is there something else that you really found off-putting?
That's about it. Honestly, like, I don't know. Like, I can't, it's hard to tell what it is, but there's something every once in a while in the writing here that makes me kind of roll my eyes. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not so much that, like, it's not that it's bad, and it's not that the ideas are a little hoity-toity. They are. But I think it's having come out of the 90s where, like, so many guys were doing this, right?
Yeah, so, like, yeah, so that's what, like, I was going to ask.
Big concept ideas like Sandman, like Promethea, like Starman, like all this, like all these things.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, though, is this, and this is the weird thing about going back and reading trades of something that you've never read previously, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think that there are a lot of things in this book that were used by other creators, where other creators are like, oh yeah, that's a great way to do this, or, you know, it had an influence maybe on the way people did things. And you've been exposed to that maybe unconsciously, that was going back to maybe this book or another book or whatever. And so in hindsight, this feels very ho-hum, this is overused, when maybe when it first came out, it wasn't. Do you ever run into that? And is that maybe what's going on here?
Totally. And I can't think right now what it was, but there's something in this book that I was like, that is a concept that I've seen used pretty much completely, like entirely, just like cut out whole cloth and used somewhere mm-hmm. else. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I wonder if they read it and they liked it and they just applied it. And I can't remember what it was in the comic and what it's used in. But as I was reading it, I was like, oh, this is like that thing from that show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And there is definitely an aspect of that, because I've read all of Promethea.
Uh-huh.
And first of all, I do wish that we had read the first 12 issues. And I'm probably, having reread this, going to go back and reread the rest of the Prometheus.
All of the whole series?
Yeah, it's 30 issues. It's, yeah. You know, it's an afternoon's read. But the thing about it is everything that I remember being good is still here. Some of the things I remember being good are great. Some of the things I remember being great are just kind of okay. So it's one of those moments where I still think this is one of the strongest overall pieces. And I think that America's Best as a whole is Moore's best use of the shared universe and the overarching concepts. But there are just bits and pieces of it where I'm like, this is sometimes the most Alan Moore thing that ever did Alan Moore.
Yeah.
And that's fine. That's good. You know, because I wouldn't read this if it were coming from someone else in some ways. There are parts of it that from another writer might really feel forced, might really feel false. And we saw that when other writers started taking over the ABC books.
Right.
Anything Tom Strong that doesn't have an Alan Moore on the cover, do not read it. Do not read Top 10 Beyond the Furthest Precinct. It's not the same thing. So the heart is gone, but the heart brings with it. It's like, let's say you've known somebody for years and years, and this is a dear friend, but you also occasionally want to strangle him.
Yeah, yeah.
That is what this book is.
So Major Spoilers Podcast, yeah, following you.
That is what this book is in a lot of ways. It's my relationship with Steven. Because
you meant my relationship with you, in which I want to strangle you constantly. Yeah,
well, yeah, you do understand that it's the same relationship, right? It's two.
No one wants to strangle me.
When Steven closes his eyes, the world disappears.
Of course. That's why I never go to sleep.
Exactly. But yes, this is something that I think only a few comics people could do well. I think Moore could do this. I think Grant Morrison could do this. I think Steve Gerber could do this. But it takes bits and pieces of comics and comic strips and mythology and your Doc Savage pulps, and it takes these weird, you know, literary hoity-toity references. It takes a little bit of real-world history. We do see chunks of World War I in here that are mm-hmm. utterly heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
And it tries to synthesize this overarching world where it all works together. He did something similar in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where the premise is every single fictional story all took place in the same universe.
Right, right.
This is something that is very hard to do. And the fact that it works as well as it does is amazing. And it's a good read.
Yeah.
But then there's also the fact that it's an Alan Moore read. And that means that our main character, You know, Gail Simone said this, and I, right before we read this issue, I read her this on Twitter. She says that throughout Promethea, the main character is always acted upon, but is never really an active force. She doesn't necessarily have the agency.
Well, and that's, if you look at like the books of magic, is kind of the same way where Timothy did not have any control over a thing. He was just like, come on, let me lead you through all this history of magic.
And I find that to be actually like symptomatic of all of these books across different writers. You know, I remember my complaint about Planetary was that the main characters are always too late. There's this really cool, hey guys, what if there was an actual kaiju? But it was like a different type of kaiju. You guys show up just in time for it to die. Like,
right.
I mean, it's
what if the Hulk actually existed, but he died 20 years ago and you totally missed it, you guys?
Right, exactly. What if there was an alternate reality with all these superheroes, but now a guy is telling you about him and now he's dead? Right? It's like there's like all of these things. I mean, the companions that Morpheus takes around are similar. You know, in that book, maybe not so much because the main character is, but actually, no, like a lot of the times, Dream isn't the main character of Sandman.
Right.
So, yeah, there's a lot of this stuff, like this kind of like basically through the 90s, 80s, 90s, and into the very early
2000s.
Yeah,
beyond.
And that today. Has these like cool, high concept things. That I don't know if they necessitate, but they're definitely written as this journey that this character is going on that they basically have no control over.
Right. And you could almost say that even Doctor Who tells that same kind of story where the companions are our connection to this world and we're just along for the ride, just like the companions are. Sometimes they have to die, but sometimes they get dropped off in a different century and live out the rest of their life.
And even in the 11th Doctor's case, the Doctor is almost being dragged along.
I don't remember how... I don't remember how this came up onto my radar. This was like, about 2 months ago or something like this, where I was aware of the book, but I just wasn't aware of it. You know, it's kind of like, oh, yes, I remember, you know, ABC stuff. But for some reason, this had slipped my radar back in 99, probably because I was going through a bunch of other things during that period. But I picked up all five of the volumes. So I started reading through this a couple of months ago. And so I'm very interested in continuing on and seeing this thing through the end, only because so many people are like, this is Alan Moore's best work. Rodrigo, are you interested in reading this to the end, all the way to the epic end of the world moment?
I am. And I can see why people say that this is Moore's best work, because it's got, it's got all those cool ideas, but it's under control. It's like it's going somewhere. I do want to see how it goes. I hadn't heard anything about it. So when people are like, you know, just hearing you guys be like, and then it devolves into XYZ, I'm like, oh, do I want to get into that? I mean, I'm definitely interested, because it's like, if nothing else, this is somebody doing something clever with superheroes, right? It's, it's about the only way that you get me to read a Capes and Tights book nowadays is somebody basically scraping out everything that's underneath the surface and supplanting it with something else. And then superheroes on top is kind of how I go about it nowadays. And this is basically that. This is a lot of interesting takes on classic pulp and superhero tropes.
Well, in addition to that, I guess I'm interested in the historical, mythic, magical view that Moore is coming from. And kind of like when you read Grant Morrison from, you know, a higher elevation, you get a different meaning from it. I'm wondering if there is that same kind of thing here in this series. And that's, even though it's wrapped up in the superhero cape, tied with a bow there so that you can access it, I'm wondering if there is something more there, and that is why I'm going to probably continue to read this.
It's more of a toga, really.
Yeah, something like that. Final thoughts, Matthew?
I have read all of this, and it is worth the read. And even the issue that people are very, very concerned about and telling you to watch out for when you get there is issue 8, which is an issue-long story about tantric magic that is basically an issue-long sex scene.
Well, I know that. Is that the same? Because that's the one. I haven't gotten that far yet. But someone else was saying you have to be aware because there's a guy that says, I will teach you magic, but you have to have sex with me first. Is that the same issue?
That is the same issue. It's basically yes and no. Basically, he's teaching her sex magic, which is another thing that, you know, Alan Moore is totally into in real life, supposedly. Sure. So, and, you know, that's one of those things where if you go in knowing that it's an Alan Moore joint.
Mm-hmm.
I actually kind of like the fact that sex becomes a part of this story in a way that doesn't feel incredibly prurient and doesn't feel like it's tacked on like so many sex scenes, not mentioning any names, called All-Star Batman and Robin. But there's also the problem where if you come in and you're not ready for that, or you're not interested in that, or if for whatever reason the perspective that he takes on that, and it is a troubling perspective in many ways, that can definitely throw you. But again, as with anything more, what he's trying to get to with that story, actually, at the end of it, you can kind of feel where the point is and why it happened the way it happened. It's actually the character in Jack Faust that we meet this volume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's also, I mean, it's something that you definitely want to watch for. It's something that could throw you. And when you get to the point where you realize what's actually going on about issue 2024, you're like, they can't be doing this. They can't be doing this. And then issue 29 comes around and they're doing it, you guys. And they're doing it straightforward. And there is nothing you can do to stop it. And I want to say issue 30 is a series of massive fold-out single-page spreads that is just utterly gorgeous and completely impossible to read.
All right.
I recommend it to anyone and everyone. I think Promethea is really, really good stuff. If you're over 18 and maybe you're bored with your capy tights, this is someplace you can go that's still, you know, comic book adjacent, really good comic book storytelling. And, you know, if you like Iron Man, you can still kind of look at this and go, yeah, I can. Okay.
All right, cool. Rodrigo, final thoughts from you?
Promethea has a lot of interesting takes on a lot of interesting things, and it's very Alan Moore-ish and very much a product of its time, and not necessarily in a bad way. This is like the kind of like high-end thinking person's comics that were coming out at the time, and that's cool. I like it. I enjoy it. I think that... I think if you're looking for a break from just punch-em-ups type superheroes, this is a good place. I think that it's interesting. Had I read this back when it came out, I probably wouldn't have liked it because I have this fundamental issue with poorly explained superhero powers, which is actually one of my main complaints against Starman. But I've really come to realize that what powers a superhero has are only one of the themes that superhero comics can deal with. So I'm glad that I'm reading this now and not back in 99, because I would have been like, well, unless you tell me exactly what she can do, I'm just going to assume that you're just going to continue to cheat the plot by giving her new powers every time, which they kind of do anyway. But that doesn't matter. The powers don't actually matter.
If you can dream it, you can achieve it. That's her powers.
Yep. Yep.
Don't power of imagination. Tony Robbins it.
That's
don't.
Not Tony Robbins. I think that if you want to read this book, and I would recommend it, be prepared for some deep thoughts and be prepared to think about some deep thoughts
with Jack Handy,
because that's what Moore is doing, is like, hey, I want to tell you some deep thoughts about some things that I'm into, but the only way I'm going to get you to do it, if I put somebody in a cape and a tight and somebody else that has some other powers and then some bad guys in it. So go in with it with that. But I say pick it up. You can get it in digital format. I'm pretty sure you can get it through the Amazon link at majorspoilers.com. It's not going to cost you anything else. A little bit comes back our way. So I'm giving this a thumbs up. So there you go. All right, everybody. I think that wraps it up for this issue. Thank you for being part of the Major Spoilers experience. We're going to be back next week. I don't know what we're talking about this week, next week. I've got a big blank in my schedule, but it'll be something about comics, because we know that you love comics and we do too. And we will talk with you soon.
Stop talking about comic books or I'll kill you. Continue to do.
Batman's a clone. Stop spending all our cash on back issues of The Flash, or I swear to God you're gonna spend your twilight years alone.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.